And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Can you feel it? The winds of change? In some ways, it seems everything suddenly is up in the air. As the president watches his train leaving the platform without him, the great war on terror becomes ever more terrifying. Good old Mother Nature slams a hurricane right into the heart of the oil distribution center, and that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker. Well, what did happen to all those reports that he'd been rediscovered? The answer, my friends, is blowing in the winds of change. And we're going along for the ride when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Many would say that the world is a manifestation of the struggle between opposites, the positive and negative charges of the atom upon which all things depend, seems to keep popping up in various dualities of life, such as male and female, that essentially defines life itself. Life and death, good and evil, freedom and tyranny, war and peace. And somehow it seems that many of these struggles are acting out with greater passion with every passing day. As pro-globalizationists meet behind barriers, as anti-globalists scream and wail, and as a president finds himself ever more isolated, even by those who crafted him. And Russia turns its missiles towards Europe, as the U.S. plants its missiles along the Russian border. And China races headlong into a full-scale industrial mega-machine, while millions flee the land from drought, and pollution burns the eyes of even the dreamers. In just a moment, we launch our second month of weekly Earth Summits, and as you'll see, there's a new voice emerging, and it appears our time is coming, a time when a return to nature is a good thing. If only we can figure out how to beat the forces of chaos, overconsumption, overpopulation, and, of course, global climate change. Now, in segment two, I love classical scientific research, and today we talk with two researchers who've spent the last 2 years trying to confirm the recent reports that that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, thought to be extinct for over 40 years, had recently been sighted. You remember the story, and then it kind of disappeared. Well, we're heading to Alabama to talk with Dr. Jeffrey Hill as he concludes his second year of intensive field study to prove that the ivory-billed woodpecker is, indeed, still with us. And then we head into the field, or shall we say swamp, as we talk with Brian Rolick, graduate student under Dr. Hill, who has lived in the middle of the Chuctahatchee Swamp in a tent for 10 full months. What's it like being a field biologist? You'll hear the full story, but first, we take you to the weekly Earth Summit that is about to convene right now. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is Sydney Wildsmith, and today we're going to hear from our regular guests, and as you'll hear, something is changing in the realms of nature and the environment. We'll compare notes as the summit ends, but now it's time we hear what's on the mind of our eight amazing guests. With so much challenging news these days about our future and the environment, it's always refreshing to hear about new discoveries. Dr. Robin Moore, Conservation International's leading amphibian action advocate, shares some exciting news from the field. Dr. Moore?
When it comes to reporting the findings of scientific research, Nothing grabs the public's attention quite like the discovery of new species. This week, we learned that 24 new species were found in the South American highlands of Suriname. These new findings included a black and fluorescent purple harlequin frog. The new species were uncovered by an expedition of 13 scientists led by Leanne Alonso of Conservation International, and the expedition took place only 80 miles from the capital of Suriname. The 24 new species included 6 species of fish, 12 dung beetles, a new species of ant, and 5 new amphibians. The researchers also found 27 species native to the Guyana Shield region, including the rare armored catfish, which has not been seen for 50 years. In all, the scientists reported 467 species at 2 sites, including monkeys, large cats, reptiles, amphibians, fish, bats, and insects. The areas in which the new species were discovered are, however, unprotected and may be threatened by small-scale illegal gold mining. The mining can pollute the water if not controlled properly, impacting amphibians, fish, as well as people. Stories of new discoveries such as this remind us that there are still parts of the world that remain unexplored by humans, and there's still much that we have to learn about our planet. It's easy to become jaded by doom and gloom stories about the environment. People generally don't like to hear about species going extinct. They do like to hear about new species being discovered. It is comforting to hear the occasional positive story. Anything that makes the public sit up and take an interest in species and the environment is, in my opinion, a good thing. The more people care, the more they will want to do to protect what we have.
Thanks, Dr. Moore. I'm sure you can feel the momentum and awareness finally building to appreciate, once again, animals and wonder. Dr. Mark Beckhoff, who serves the wild creatures as he advocates for the increased realization around the globe that animals must be treated as worthy and honored cohabitants. He shares some recent news.
There was an article called I Am an Elephant that appeared in a newspaper in Philadelphia that really, really decried the keeping of elephants in captivity and how they need to go to sanctuaries and not be kept in little prison-like cages in zoos. And what's really neat about that is the popular press is getting into the story about the way elephants and, of course, other animals suffer trauma. And what's really interesting is that 6 zoos in America have decided that they would be closing their elephant exhibits as the elephants passed away or got ill and had to be sent to a sanctuary, including the Bronx Zoo, the Detroit Zoo, the Philadelphia Zoo.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. What's really exciting these days is the way in which some solutions to our globalizing challenge have been around literally for millions of years. Dr. Lovejoy, please tell us, what's on your mind this week?
A part of the solution suggested for a new energy scenario is to use biological resources as fuels. The Brazilians have been using sugarcane to produce alcohol for their automobile fleet for 30-odd years. And there's no question that these so-called biofuels will be an important part of the solution. But as usual, the devil is in the details, and it matters what you grow, where you grow it, and how you grow it. And I think one of the most intriguing possibilities is actually to use our native tall grass prairie, multi-species community of grasses, which are highly productive in the natural community. And at the end of their long growing season, they take all their critical nutrients back down into the root system. And all that's left above ground is cellulose, from which one can make cellulosic ethanol. So there you have a system which closely bases itself on a natural system that requires little input in terms of fertilizer or energy. So once again, we find important solutions in the natural world.
Dr. Thomas Lovejoy directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. And it's no wonder he sees such elegant examples that incorporate the three pillars of the center. Carl Pope directs the Sierra Club that has always been willing to push the wheels of change onto the right path. He shares, too, his observations that there are great things happening. Carl?
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the greenest of them all? Tulsa, Oklahoma?
the 500th American city to sign Kyoto? Utah, whose governor signed up for the fight on global warming, saying, "We are leading the charge. Washington has failed." New York City, where Mayor Mike Bloomberg took on the taxi drivers, cantankerous as they are, every taxi will be a hybrid within 5 years. Or Los Angeles, where Mayor Villaraigosa promptly raised Bloomberg, promising that the city of the angels, not the Big Apple, will be the greenest in the country. Or maybe it's J.P. Morgan, which told its investors, stay away from utilities that don't get efficiency. But it's not Washington. It still treats energy as the private playpen of the carbon monopolies. So much for coal, so much for oil, so much for gas and nuclear. Why don't you tell Congress it's time for action, not play acting?
Thank you, Carl. You're not the only one who sees a radical disconnect between the people's great wisdom and emerging sense of action and the administration as it continues to run off the road through our sacred lands. More and more people are taking action. Emma Sleeth, who is active in the Creation Care Movement, offers a unique play on the act in action.
There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for star differs from another star in glory. In fifth grade, I was in a class that put on a production of Macbeth. This was an annual thing. My brother had done it 2 years earlier. Only one problem. My class didn't have enough people, especially guys. There were maybe 9 kids in the class, but only 2 of them were male. Okay, when you think of Macbeth, who do you think of? Yes, the 3 witches and Lady Macbeth are female, but pretty much every other character is male. Obviously, we had to do double casting, and my teacher tried very hard to work with what she had, but it was challenging. Once we thought we had it all worked out, until the last scene, in which Douglas had to duel against, well, himself. But after much shuffling and recasting, we finally had it. Everyone had parts in which they didn't have to talk to themselves in a scene. Except Lady Macbeth, of course, but she's supposed to do that. And somehow, I was Macbeth. Now, I'm no actress, let alone actor, but I tried my best. I spent hours and hours on the bus memorizing, practicing saying Montulius, a word which I still have a hard time pronouncing, and silently envying Clark, who had been narrator 2 when his class had done it. I felt that I was cast wrong. The other girl named Emma in the class was the best actress. The only reason she wasn't Macbeth was that her identical twin sister was Lady, which might have been confusing for the audience. I should have stayed in the wings, where I belonged. I should have gotten the part of narrator 2, just like my brother. I might have had the dedication to the part of Macbeth and the literary love for his character, but I didn't have the acting skills or pronunciation, the knack for memorization, or the ability to convince an audience that a pipsqueak fifth-grade girl was really a murderous, raving king of Scotland that I was supposed to be. In the environmental movement, it is the same way. We often feel that God has cast us wrong, that we don't have the talents or skills for the job he has given us. We prefer to be a Macbeth in the wings. But that's not where we belong, not where he's told us to be. He's told us what our part is, whether narrator or lead, and we should be that part. That doesn't mean that he won't use the gifts that he's given us, that we're naturally good at, but it does mean it's a possibility. As is often said, God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called. Star differs from star in glory. What has he called you to do? Has he asked you to be a leader? Has he asked you to narrate? Or has he asked you just to be in the audience as an active listener and educated citizen? Whatever he's asked you to do, do it. What if the sun had decided that it would really rather just be the moon? And what will happen to the ecosystem if a Macbeth of the environmental movement decides he'd really rather be in the wings?
Emma Sleeth has a book coming out that is directed to much of the faith-based community that is re-embracing its sacred responsibility to this earthly paradise. And speaking of books about the earth, Dave Foreman gives you this summer's reading list for your vacation, beach, and long summer evenings. Dave?
One of my real worries about the conservation movement today is that people aren't reading the classic conservation books. I find that a lot of young conservation activists who are very good at what they do haven't read the classic books, and this sometimes gets them into trouble because they don't know the lore and history of our movement. we need to do a lot more reading. On the other hand, I often get questions from people about what are the most important conservation books and what should they be reading to learn about different topics. Well, to answer that question, on the Rewilding Institute website, www.rewilding.org, I've launched a new feature called Books of the Big Outside, in which I do short reviews of the most important conservation books in a variety of categories. Right now, there's 18 categories of conservation books I have there, and a total of 345 titles. Majority of those I do have short reviews, others I'm doing reviews for, but the Books of the Big Outside section is up and running. And so for those of you who might want to know what are the most important conservation books to read, what does it require a conservationist to be educated, to have some book learning, I would say the six most important books, and this I list in a six-pack of books from Uncle Dave, would be A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, Overshoot by William Catton, The Arrogance of Humanism by David Ehrenfeld, Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey, Wilderness in the American Mind by Roderick Nash, and The Diversity of Life by E.O. Wilson. Of recent books published in the last year or two, this six-pack would be Last Great Wilderness, Campaign to Establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay, Predatory Bureaucracy, The Extermination of Wolves, and the Transformation of the West by Michael Robinson, Let My People Go Surfing by Yvon Chouinard, The Winds of Change, Climate, Weather, and the Destruction of Civilizations by Eugene Linden, Rewilding North America, A Vision for Conservation in the 21st Century by yours truly, Dave Foreman, and Large Carnivores and the Conservation of Biodiversity, edited by Justina C. Ray. And if you want to learn about those books and many more, check out the Books of the Big Outside section on the Rewilding Institute website, rewilding.org. Thank you. Happy reading.
It's great to have an icon like Dave bring his years of dedication to saving the wild places to get us all more on the same page. Thanks, Dave. It's really quite hopeful, as Dr. Charles Kennel points out. Dr. Kennel?
Well, that's the hopeful side of it, isn't it? It's the one problem that everybody has. And even when the dialogue on other parts of our, international politics goes sour, we can still find a common interest in trying to solve this problem. And there is an analog in the past during the Cold War, which didn't involve everybody, but it was still the case that the scientists in particular managed to talk to each other on both sides of the Iron Curtain throughout the Cold War, and both sides realized they had a mutual interest in preventing a nuclear war, which thus far we have done. And so that was a huge achievement, and it was because there was a mutual interest that stretched across what looked like unbridgeable ideological and social chasms. And the same may be true now as we look at our fragmented global civilization and societies. But we all have this one interest, and we've got to find ways to work together on that. And that may build a bridgehead to a much closer and better relationship amongst all the societies of the world.
Thanks, Dr. Kettle. I wish I had the knowledge that you have from your years at NASA, Scripps, and the Pew Foundation. Few live with as broad a vision as our great friend, Dr. Charles Kennel. And sometimes, great wisdom is best expressed in a down-home fashion. And I'm finding that no one does that better than our final regular, here on the Weekly Earth Summit, Dr. Matthew Sleeth. Dr. Sleeth?
We try hard to keep our trash footprint light. We recycle everything possible. We use cloth shopping bags. And we practice pre-cycling, which is buying items with minimal packaging or in bulk or not at all. Recently, we've been doing some remodeling work on our home. Due to construction waste, we would have blown our trash footprint. We were saved from blowing our footprint by free cycling. Free cycling allows us to post the items we weren't going to use on a social network. Used baby cribs, exercise machines, bicycles, and cookware are cleaned out of one's closet and gotten by those needing the items. My wife, Nancy, posted our leftover lumber and even used wallboard on www.freecycle.org. Then people in our community came and removed the items. It's how we got our outdoor composting system last summer. There are 4,000-plus local free cycling communities nationwide and 3.5 million members. The one thing you can't do is sell your stuff. It's all free. You get to meet your neighbors, save money, and clean out your spare room or decorate it for free. Sometimes you get the chance to help neighbors that have lost everything in a flood, divorce, or other disaster. www.freecycle.org. One man's trash is another's treasure.
I've signed up with Free Cyclers here in San Diego, and I'm looking forward to spreading my lifelong collections of stuff, much of which is now in boxes and drawers and taking up room in my studio. Thanks, Matthew, for your wise and practical advice. So what did we learn from this weekly Earth Summit? I learned that we are making progress, that all these things we've been talking about and writing about and thinking about and worrying about for much of our lives is now reaching the threshold of action. Let's keep that big wheel rolling. This is Sidney Wildsmith thanking you for being part of the weekly Earth Summit. We've really just begun. In just a moment, we bring you up to the moment about the recent field work from the Choctahatchee Swamps, where the legendary and elusive ivory-billed woodpecker just may be hiding when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.